Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Old man rhythm is in my shoes. It's no use to sitting and singing the blues. So be my guest, you've got nothing to lose. Won't you let me take you on a sea cruise?
All right, it's the Savage Nation. If you're not having fun on radio, then get away from the microphone because no one wants to listen to a cranky old man. The first thing I learned when I went in this business is have fun on the radio. And let me tell you something, not too many people are still having fun on the radio. They're running scared and you can hear it, and that's why people are turning off the radio. Now, it's hard to have fun when you have a Marxist president who is destroying jobs. And you have a first lady spending money like the Queen of England was in the 19th century or the 18th century, and it not appearing in the news because they cover the backsides of the president and the first lady like never before in history. It's very difficult, and that's why I tell you we're going to have some fun in the Savage Nation. In addition to all of the news of the day, which I'm going to do, remember I was saying how did we go from a time when I was a kid, for example, when even poor Italian people who were in my grew up in my neighborhood, they looked up to opera stars. Even the poorest Italians could sing an aria or try to sing an aria. Their role models were people such as Mario Lanza, later on Pavarotti. And take a look at the degeneracy today of a culture where Jersey Shore and the Sopranos are held up as the role models for Italians. Or take a look at the Jewish people. When I was a boy, Jonas Salk was held up as a role model. Take a look at what we have now, Anthony Weiner. When I was a boy, Martin Luther King Jr. was a role model for black people. Take a look at the rapper garbage we have today in the United States of America. And so without further ado, let's go to the wonderful sound production describing the role models and the leadership of the past to the present, from dignity to depravity, on the Savage Nation.
We have fun, we're fearless. I mean, we go into the room, we kill it. We go into the club, we kill it. Photo shoots, we kill it. We're in Miami, we're killing it. On the beach, we're killing it.
That's just how we do since day one.
I believe that the future generations will look back upon us and judge us as to whether we have been wise or whether we have been profligate and wasteful.
I will not yield to the gentleman, and the gentleman will observe regular order. The gentleman will observe regular order.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
I said a hip hop, the hip to the hip, hip hop, you don't stop the rocker to the bang bang boogie, say up jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogie.
So there we go, from Pavarotti to the degenerate filth of Jersey Shore, the illiterate morons, from Jonas Salk to Anthony Weiner, from Martin Luther King Jr. to a rapper who can hardly speak the English language. Now let's go to the next one, which we put together. We're going to compare, for those of you who are not of any of those ethnicities or proclivities, we're going to go to a comparison between Dylan Thomas, a Welsh poet, and Amy Winehouse, an otherwise nobody who somebody doesn't love. We're then going to go to Edward R. Murrow compared with Chris Matthews, a man who belongs in an Alzheimer's ward, in my opinion. We're then going to show you a Hispanic gentleman named Luis Alvarez, one of the great physicists who you probably never heard of, who got where he was without affirmative action, without the government helping him along. And then we're going to compare Luis Alvarez, scientist, Nobel Prize winner, with Representative Gutierrez. Then we're going to compare Madame Curie to Lady Gaga right now on the Savage Nation.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
We must remember always that accusation is not proof and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law.
The feeling most people get when they hear a Barack Obama speech, I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
Steady.
I was following my father's advice. I said to myself, let's just sit down in a chair and spend all evening and see what you can come up with.
In the same manner as we have stood up, when the rule of law said to a woman, you will not earn equal pay, when someone of sexual orientation is abused, we say that will not be tolerated.
Magnesium oxide, 99/100%. Other extraneous matter, 0.001%.
I wrote this speech, this address, myself. My address to you today is called The Prime Rib of America.
Is this over your head, under your head, on your head, or between the eyes?
Savage.
In California, they're releasing convicts, felons, for medical reasons. And they're finding that it's medically advantageous to release them. So they're releasing a man who was sentenced for a 2006 home invasion robbery. And he was granted parole under a new law authorizing the release of medically incapacitated inmates are being released from prison. And this has been pushed by the psychopath Senator Mark Lino, a troublemaking lunatic, in my opinion, from San Francisco, a Democrat loser who has argued for this continuously since he became a state senator. The new law states that inmates who are permanently medically incapacitated with a medical condition which makes them unable to perform activities of basic daily living may be released if they do not pose a threat to public safety. So they're releasing Craig Lemke. Poses no threat to public safety due to his medical condition. A two-member panel of the state board of parole hearings found during a hearing at the Pleasant Valley State Prison in Coalinga. Now, let's go into his history. This guy, Lemke, was released because they say he's no threat to society. But he served time in prison in the 80s and the 90s for three previous felony convictions, including robbery, transporting or importing a controlled substance, and possession of a weapon. He was sentenced in 2007 under California's three strikes law, and now he's being released because they have the idea that he's medically incapacitated. The first inmate to be considered for release under Leno's psychopathic law was convicted rapist Stephen Martinez, 42, but he was found to pose a threat to public safety and was rejected for release. Martinez became a quadriplegic after being stabbed in prison. Do you know how much these people are costing the state, both in and out of prison? Do you have any idea what they cost? You're gonna die when you hear this. You're not gonna believe this. Some of them cost the state up to $1.35 million a year for medical care if they're cared in a nursing facility or an outside hospital. Hospice care for these felons within the prison system costs around $110,000 a year. Then there's the cost of guarding these medically incapacitated inmates. If an inmate's housed at a hospital outside prison walls, the cost averages $750,000 per person per year. $750,000 per person per year to guard the medically dismissed inmate in a hospital outside. Why? Because liberal prison policy dictates that two correctional officers must stand guard 24 hours a day, even if an inmate is incapable of moving. I want you to see what liberalism has wrought. Liberalism, the mental disorder, as exemplified, in my opinion, by possibly the sickest man in the history of California politics, Senator Mark Leno, who's been pushing this like mad, calling it humane. Convict wins California's first medical parole. So when he goes out and he kills somebody, well, who's going to pay for that? You think Mr. Leno will pay for it? He's not responsible. Remember, Democrats, I did not have sex with that woman. I am not at war with Libya. I pose no threat to public safety. There are no consequences. Do you understand this?
Savage.
I'm going to take some lifestyle calls, okay? New York, WOR, Mazal. Mazal, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi.
I'm not sure if I should continue my studies with a PhD or perhaps go into publishing or writing.
Question, what's your field? What is your field of endeavor?
Literature, English.
Okay, what do you have right now, a master's?
Master's.
And you want to get a PhD. Have you started your studies yet?
No, I took a couple of courses, but they're not applicable to a PhD.
Let me explain something. A PhD is a research degree. That's number one. It's going to take you 3 to 5 years. Is that correct?
Probably.
Maybe more. Mm-hmm. And what are you going to get at the end of the 5 years? Let's say you get that PhD. You're going to have to apply for a teaching position in an English department, correct?
Right.
There are no jobs. They're dismissing people, unfortunately. And so, therefore, although you have a scholar's, inclinations, in the real world, there's no room for scholars in America anymore.
No.
It's like the buggy whip. I mean, where's room for scholars in America today?
I don't know.
So that let me finish. You could go into publishing, which is also a very, very risky road, incidentally. I mean, unless have you looked at the jobs available in publishing right now?
I do not receive any responses, and I published my own book, The Silent Sister, and it's very difficult just to have people respond.
Correct. Let me explain something. The publishing industry is contracting rapidly. You had major bankruptcies last year of bookstore chains, which had ramifications into the bottom line of publishers who got stiffed for money that was owed by, I believe, what was it, the Borders chain that went bankrupt? I wouldn't look in the publishing industry for a position today. It's not 1960 where there was an unlimited future. So, yes, you're an intelligent young woman. You love literature. You probably eat, drink, and sleep ideas and words, correct?
You've got it.
Okay, so you're asking how can you make a living and enjoy your life as well and have your intellect engaged? That's the toughest question on earth.
Wow.
There's no tougher question, I mean, other than life and death questions, but there's almost no tougher question to answer than that because I have no answer for you. In other words, I've told you both choices are bad, and I'm reluctant to give you that answer, but I'm telling you, having looked forward and backward in my own life, there are things I would have done a little differently. For me, maybe it's worked out in some ways and not in others. But the life of the scholar, fraught with peril and a life of poverty, your entire life is going to be begging and working for people who are basically your intellectual inferior your whole life, who got appointed for reasons other than their scholarship, no doubt based upon either their race or their immigration status, who are going to wind up being your boss telling you that they're better than you are with a lower degree. So do you want to go down that road? No. So then you say publishing. You're going to start like they used to start in the 60s in the mailroom and think you're going to wind up as a publisher? It's not going to happen anymore. The chances of it happening are very, very dim. So where does that leave you now? Let's say both choices are not valid. What would you do then?
Continue teaching in a local high school, I guess.
Well, let me say something. Life could be worse than teaching in a local high school. That's if there's a job in a local high school. You know, there are many people who are, let us say, given towards the arts, but there's no road towards success in the arts in terms of a living, let's put it that way. And if you don't have a private family fortune to rely upon, you'll have to do what thousands, if not tens of thousands, of other people with such inclinations have done in the past. You teach, or if they were musicians, they gave music lessons when they really didn't want to teach kids how to play the piano, but they had to do it. And on the side, you maintain your interest, which becomes your avocation until it can become your vocation. I know it's a terrible dose of reality that I'm throwing your way, and it's probably very depressing to listen to this, but I think I'm doing you a favor at the end of the day. Don't waste your time with a PhD.
Thank you. Number one.
And number two, go get a teaching job if you can, and then see what your options are. That's all.
Savage.
I got good callers. Let's see. Here's a good one out of Mississippi. Stefan, welcome to the program.
Yes, Dr. Savage, my question is, with all your PhDs and master's degrees in herbology, how did you get started in radio?
Well, first of all, my PhD is in nutrition epidemiology from the University of California at Berkeley. You know, it's in human nutrition and epidemiology, two hard sciences. I had two previous master's degrees, one in medical anthropology and one in medical botany. The medical botany master's was equal to a high-end PhD anywhere else, because my master's thesis was published in a journal that is published at Harvard University. So my master's level thesis was as good as anyone's PhD, if not better. How did I go from all of that to talk radio is the question?
Yes, sir.
Oh, it's such a long story. It's worthy of an autobiography. I'll have to summarize it in some regard. I'll make it as short as I can. I don't want to bore anybody. Let us say, because I was a white male, I was denied access to the universities, which is really what I wanted at the time, because I would have been a great scholar. I had shown great promise and published some incredibly insightful scientific papers, but they were not hiring white males at the time in these fields. They were only hiring incompetents from the third world or women with 10th rate degrees, and that's why the fields have produced little or no scholarship whatsoever. So I had to reinvent myself, so I did corporate consulting, I wrote books, et cetera, and so on. But I continued my research. I funded my own travels to the South Pacific. It was a big juggling act. And then around the year 1994, I sent out a demo tape to 450 radio stations that I put together, like a fake radio show with callers. My friends called in and all that. And about five radio stations said, "You're good. Would you like to, you know, be on our air?" Include one was in Boston, and a couple were in San Francisco. And then I went in and did fill-in work in San Francisco, night work, overnight fill-in. Then they offered me a full-time job. Then I was syndicated in the year 2000. And here it is. That's how it. That's basically the story.
Yeah, thank you very much, Frank.
Thanks for the call. In other words, I reinvented myself. You see, the young man said he was fed up with he can't make a living, he can't make a job. Well, society said we have social engineering going on right now, and white males need not apply. Now, I could have spent the rest of my life as an embittered intellectual, hating the world. They did it to me, chip on my shoulder, and gotten nowhere the rest of my life. I could have been one of the bums sitting in a cafe, disgruntled, you know, retired or living on SDSI or whatever I put together in my life, been just a miserable human being the way most of these disgruntled people are. Instead, because I didn't want to be a loser and a bad role model for my children, I decided to struggle at age 50 and start all over again, which I did. Which I did, by the way. And, you know, here I am, thank God.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Hi, this is Dr. Savage, your lifestyle coach here. We're going to shift away from politics for the moment and go to what's really important, and that's the personal. If you have a personal question, a lifestyle question, a life coach question that I can help you with, just give us a call at 1-800-449-8255. Remember, people are paying $500 an hour and more for this kind of advice. So if you're lucky enough to get through the call screener and get onto the Savage Nation, you're going to earn some of the best advice you've ever heard right here on the Dr. Savage Lifestyle segment.
I'm not even in the mood to do this. I mean, we played the thing. I'm in a strange mood. Who knows? I don't know what it is. Maybe the weather, this, and I don't know what. Do you want me to be a lifestyle coach now? Do you want me to talk about them, the this, the that? The portions got smaller. The shrimp got smellier. And the smiles got larger. So that was a. Everywhere I go, it's the same thing. Even the fishmonger that I go to, the fish was no good yesterday. I had the worst cooking experience of. Do you want to hear this or not? I normally like to. I go into. No one's interested in the next man's problems. I cooked a fish at home last night. I didn't even like, and I smelled the fish like my aunt taught me in the fish store. I learned 40 years ago when she'd go in the butcher shop and look at the meat because she didn't trust him then. Now, believe me, she you know, the butcher knew her, but he cheated her anyway. She went into a freezer in August in a fur coat to make sure he wasn't giving a bad meat. So I learned then and there not to trust the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker. And so now I buy a piece of fish and I smell it in the store. I knew it was not fresh. I knew it wasn't sour. I wouldn't have bought it. So he said, "Fresh today." I said, "Yeah, all right, it's 2 days old." Because I know fishermen, they tell you the freshest fish is 2 days old. That's number two. Unless you're buying it off the boat, and even there it's 2 days old. How old do you think fish is on a boat? So already it's 4 days old. This smelled already probably like Gendelman's underwear, like 5 days. I don't know, whatever. I tried a new recipe. I tried oven-baked. It was horrible. I'm not an oven baker. You know why I don't like using an oven for cooking? You want to hear why? It's not fast enough. You see, it's interesting about cooking. I may do a cooking show and leave politics behind because I'll tell you the truth. There's all you can see the whole world in a sauté pan. Why do I like a sautéed meal better? Because it's faster. Okay, cooks in front of you. An oven, you're looking in every 2 minutes through the glass. Every 2 minutes looking. Is it cooking? Is it not cooking? Is it boiling? Is it not boiling? Do I think it's cooking? How do you know if it's cooked through an oven? Who has the time to sit and wait? It's from another era, an oven. It's when you had nothing to do but drink wine and look in a hot oven. I can make fish in 4 minutes. The guy taught me how to do it. 3 minutes on one side, flip it, 2 minutes on the other. It's over. It's crispy. It's golden. That's the end of the fish. It took me 30 years to learn how to saute a fish properly. And I'm more excited about talking about how to cook a fish. But I'm going to take some life coach questions now. Let's go to Florida. Bob, you're on the Savage Nation. Bob, what's on your mind?
Savage, I love trickle up poverty. Okay, I got this issue. I'm 30 years old. I've been doing my job for 5 years, and I don't make much money. I can't seem to move up in the position. I have a master's degree. I have 5 years experience, yet everybody in this position above me gets hired on by my Hispanic female boss, and they don't even have so much as a bachelor's degree. Well, I have a master's. They don't have any experience.
All right, hold on. So there's discrimination going on in your company is what you're hinting at. Is that correct?
I don't know if it is, because some white people do move up, but you're usually a minority. Some Jewish people move up, sometimes people that have different situations. So I don't know if it's outright racist.
Well, let's stop for a minute. Do they have better educations or equal educations to you? And let's start with the basics. The people who are moving ahead of you, do they have equal or better experience and equal or better education?
No.
Okay, hold on. Do they perform better somehow at the job itself? Is it a business related to sales?
No, it isn't. But 90% of my employees I work with love my job. They respect me. They say I do a great job. So I know.
So let me ask you, make believe I'm an arbitrator. What are the parameters that are being used to judge whether an individual should be promoted?
I would say whether or not they can do their job punctually and ethically and do it sufficiently.
Than those being promoted above you?
Absolutely, especially ethically, and just with knowledge overall. I've been there 5 years. They're hiring people outside of the area that have no experience and nowhere near my education.
Hold on now. Are they paying them more?
Yes.
Okay, so this could be an employment discrimination case. It might be difficult to prove for the reason that you can't give me a very strict example of the parameters that are being used for hiring and promotion. I don't know what they are.
But basically, as long as you can do the job, and it's really about it, to be honest with you.
I'll tell you what I would do if I were in your place. If you got into a dead-end situation where you felt you were being picked on because you're a white guy and they're using racial minorities to push them ahead of you, let's say you just feel it but you can't prove it, it's time for you to move on. They're doing you a favor. Whether you know it or not, what they're saying to you is, if you can do better, go ahead and do it. And you know what? Often this is the kick in the behind we need to move on in life. Let's say you got that little promotion. You might be stuck there another 5 years. Whereas on the other hand, what if you can go out in your own time, legitimately find a better job where you could say, I'm better than everybody at work, and I want to move up to a more responsible position because I'm ready for it, and make 20% more money than you would there. Wouldn't you say that would be an opportunity that you'd want?
I would. And you know, Savage, I've saved my money. I have $20,000 in the bank. I have no family. I'm single, you know. And I got no dependents, and I'm in a perfect position. I'm just afraid to take that leap, and I don't know if I should.
Well, hold on now. Wait a minute. Is it permissible for you to look for another job while working here?
Yes.
I don't mean on their time, on your own time. Are you allowed to send out and go on the internet, et cetera?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so why don't you do that and then decide? You don't have to decide now. Let me give everybody listening to this show a very important piece of advice that I learned when I went into radio, and I wasn't sure I was going to go into radio. I was a fairly successful corporate consultant at the time. I was making a reasonable living, enough to live on, taking care of the family. But I wanted something more in my life. What I did was I sent out the tape for radio to 400 and some odd stations. I mentioned this before. 5 to 7 stations said, you're great. Would you like to come work for the radio station? I didn't know what to do. I went and talked to a very brilliant old-time lawyer in Washington, D.C. He was one of the smartest men I ever met. And I said, I don't know what to do. Should I leave consulting and try radio? What if the radio doesn't pan out, that I lost my consulting jobs? He said, think of it as a horse race. Keep pushing all of the horses around the racetrack at the same time. He said, keep your consulting job. Take the radio job on a part-time basis until you find out if you're any good at it and if you really have skill for it and if they want you. And keep moving the horses around, and then you find out which horse wins. So you're not exactly in the same position. But since you don't have to give up your job in order to look for another one, what's wrong in looking for another one right now?
The trouble is, I've been looking online, and it's a big wash. You know, there's no personality these days. You can't go up and meet someone. They say, oh, you got to apply online. We can't meet with you. And I've been doing it for 2 years since I had my master's. And I know there's...
So are you afraid that if you don't look around, you're going to get stuck here in this position forever?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Go with your instincts. Obviously, you have survival instincts, so you wouldn't be where you are and get a master's degree. You're an ambitious young guy, and you want to move on. You have no choice here other than you can't take it up with your boss or supervisor?
I can't. I have. The thing is, I called them out on some crap that they were trying to throw at me, and I made the boss look bad. I did it in a civilized way. But
well, you see, now here's the problem. The minute you did that, she's now going to pick on you forever. There's nothing you could do now. You've already, the die is cast. She now sees you as an enemy. There's nothing you could do now to overcome what you've already done. And you did the right thing, but you should have calculated in advance that once you went over her head, you made her into an... She's an opponent now.
Yeah.
All right, so I got to move on. I'm going to tell you, if you were my son and you're not, use your aggression and use your intelligence to get out of that place any way you can. Okay?
Savage.
Go ahead. I like duo. Go ahead. All right, that'll work.
Because my heart is true. Come,
no, I'm too old for this. Turn it off already. I don't feel cheerful about it. I don't know. I don't feel focused today. I just feel very unfocused. I think it's my car. I'm having trouble with my car, and it's bothering me. I think I'm more connected to my car than I like to believe. Can you imagine having a car that's less than 3 years old, an expensive Mercedes? I drive an S600. About a couple of weeks ago, I came back from Florida. And the car, like the hydraulic fluid, it started to smell, and I couldn't turn the wheel. So they took the car, and it turns out that it blew a hydraulic line. All right, this happens in a car. It's three times already the car was brought in, and they allegedly used, steam cleaning. The car still stinks like burning rubber and is bothering me. I will not drive a car that smells of burning rubber. Now, to top it off, it comes back today. I'm about to sign off on it. A gouge in the right fender down to the metal, to bare metal. Can you believe this? Maybe that's what's upsetting me. I don't know. Maybe I'm more connected. Look, a man in the Middle East is connected to his camel. Isn't a man judged by his horse or his camel? Men related to their horses, to their camels, to their cars, to their planes, to their boats. I hate to admit it, that I probably am more connected to, how about the five Statons in the still of the night? Because if this keeps up, even five Statons are not going to save me today. And we'll play in the still of, we'll play in the still of the night. Our little bump and grind. That was a beautiful song in its day. Today, nothing. Kids can't even dance to this. They don't hold. They don't hold while they dance. They do individual dancing. The guy doesn't hold the girl anymore. They put on a show for each other. Two narcissists in the night on ecstasy. No, that's the whole thing. In other words, it's not male and woman, man and woman coming together at a dance. It's, if you notice it, it's the girl putting on a striptease type of a bump and grind, and the guy is standing there trying to imitate the girl. It is the new dancing. How about another one? I think I'm just going to do music. For a little while. If you want to call about any news topic, you know the number, right? You know, one of my favorite ones out there is, why do I like this one? How about Sorry I Ran All the Way Home by the Impalas? I guess I like the idea that it was the Impala, because in 1958, there was a Chevy Impala with three two-barrel carburetors that was so beautiful. And there was a rock and roll singer from the neighborhood who became very famous. Today, he's nothing. He's still performing. I can't imagine he has much. What's his name? Could you play this one? Sorry, I Ran All Over Your Home, rock and roll through. Okay, that's good. I am so glad that I was a late bloomer. What would I have done if I was an early bloomer and hit it big at 16 and was a burnout by 30? This way I struggled my entire life, suffered, walked on hot coals. And by the time you earn, you know, your mild acclaim and your fortune, it's too late, because at the end of the day, you don't even want to spend it. There's nothing you want. You're so burned out by life, there's nothing you want, truthfully, except a good meal and a night's sleep.
Savage.
So I'm on the way to the boat yesterday. I had a heck of a day. I actually was a normal man for one day in the last several years. In the morning, the normal man on Sunday went to a classic car show. Normally, I'm just on the computer grousing about the horrendous world I live in, the horrible liberalism, mental disorder. Everywhere I turn, there's a disaster. So I go to a car show with an old acquaintance who's a mechanic. And I run into a new acquaintance with the dog Duke, who's on his way to Prague. And when you just look at the cars, I tell you the truth, it is so relaxing looking at classic cars. There's no way to describe it. I can explain to you sociologically why men love beautiful machines. I can explain it, but I don't think I have to. Then in the afternoon, I went on the Potomac. It's hard to pronounce. The Potomac River. You have to think of the word tome. And I was on the boat, and a strange thing happened. I went with Mrs. S on the boat, and within a few seconds, I wanted to leave before the gangway was lifted. The crowd, there was too many people. I generally go out on my boat alone. I'm a boater on the bay, but I usually go out alone with the dog, and I like to hear the water. I don't want to hear people. Okay, let's start with that. As far as catering, I usually don't have food on my boat. I take a roll. I take a slice of provolone cheese. I take a tomato. And when I go out in the bay, I cut the engine sometimes, and I cut the roll. I put in the cheese. I put in the tomato, and I throw it in the microwave. I make a grilled cheese. To me, it's one of the finest gourmet meals with no one talking around me. Nobody, not a word. I don't need alcohol. I don't need nothing. A cup of coffee and a grilled cheese with a dog is great. I get on the boat. I was curious to go on the boat. I wanted to see the FDR's floating White House. And I saw it. I went down the engine room. I went up to the pilot house. I wanted to leave already. It's not that the people were bad. They were very nice people, but there were too many people. I got a claustrophobia attack. So before the gangway was totally lifted, I said, let's get out of here. So it turned into like a comedy where she was off the boat. I was on the boat. They had to lift the thing. Then I lowered the thing. Then the captain said, Mike, you can hang out with us. So I spent the whole time on the boat up at the pilot house. And I really tell you, I had a really wonderful time on the boat. The lamb chops were superb. The caterer was fantastic. Violated my dietary protocols every step of the way. But I learned a lot about FDR's boat. You say, well, why should you? Oh, you? He was a communist. It was built in 1934 as a Coast Guard cutter called Electra. And she had a 20-millimeter gun on her. And then she was converted to the presidential yacht USS Potomac by FDR as a U.S. Navy vessel in 1936. She's now restored, and she's used basically as a, they rent it out, you know, for cruises. It's a nonprofit organization. It was a fascinating scene for me for one reason. As a boater, one, to see such dedicated people who are dedicated to keeping this museum alive and it still functions, you number one. Number two, you see how simple the presidential yacht was on the inside. There's no woodwork to speak of. There's no paneling. There's no teak. It was austere. Compared to today's standards, the boat looks almost like a lifeboat, you know, on the inside. But yet it handles beautifully. It doesn't have stabilizers. She rolled a bit near the Golden Gate. And just sharing a little thing. She's 76 years old, and she's still cruising. That's all. That was number two. So now we can thank Dan and put the picture on the side.
Savage.
Let's go to the callers. I've talked enough. Dave in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is regarding what your discussion about Jonas Salk before. And it's funny you should bring up the subject of Jonas Salk, because he was such an important historical figure in medicine and what he did for the country and the world.
Right.
But right. the same day that he died, Jerry Garcia died. And the next day, the New York Times put Jonas Salk's obituary on page 24, and Jerry Garcia was on page 1.
Now, what does that tell you about Pinchy Sulzberger, who destroyed an institution he inherited from his father? What does that tell you about the imbalance of the lunatics who run the New York Times? You think it's overnight it happened? The grandfather, Adolf Och Sulzberger, creates a newspaper that becomes great. His son makes it into something greater, and then they give it to this loser who turns it into a rag.
Absolutely a rag. Actually, we call it the Communist Manifesto here.
It's awful. It's just beyond comprehension how anybody reads it anymore.
Yeah. Anyway.
High on cocaine. You got that song? High on cocaine.
Driving that train.
High on cocaine. Oh, how cool.
Jonesy, better watch your speed. Trouble ahead. Trouble behind. And know that notion. Just
get out of here, you filthy junkie, you cultural icon. I'm sick of them all. I'm sick of the people who control the culture. I hate them all. I hate them with a passion. Not dislike. I'm using a word that's biblically correct. I hate them for what they have done, and I hate them for what they are doing to this country. You turn on HBO, you turn on Showtime, and you see one degenerate after another that they call a comedian doing a show, a live show, debasing everything that's decent about America. And you never, ever see a talented conservative, even a talented moderate, on any of these outlets. Never. Never. There is a new blacklist that comes out of the entertainment medium. And unless you conform to the protocols of their agenda, you are not heard from. You don't work in their town. That's why I say we need fairness and we need balance. We need a censorship board to control the vermin of Hollywood and the vermin in the newsrooms of New York City.
There's nothing on radio like the Michael Savage Show.
I want to cover some Hebrew literature in English. Tell me if you disagree with this. Rabbi Bendoza said, anyone whose fear of sin comes before his wisdom will endure. But anyone whose wisdom comes before his fear of sin, his wisdom will not endure. Now, I could spend an hour talking about that because you never hear this stuff. Unless you're a very religious person who reads this and hears about it in a formal setting, you will not hear it.
Listen to the Michael Savage Show on this station. Check your local station website or broadcast times to feel the power of the Michael Savage Show. You want to experience the full impact of the Michael Savage Show? Become a premium member and get Savage Live, Savage Archives, and the Savage Podcast. Go to www.trncentral.com. That's trncentral.com. Click on Savage's picture and get hooked up with the Michael Savage Show today. Savage.
bonus round time. If you can't teach an old dog new tricks, what can you teach him?
Conversational French?
Correct.
Ooh.
Gingerbread men are...
Gingerbread boys, all grown up.
Correct. True or false, Netflix lets you watch movies instantly through your game console or other devices.
Duh, true.
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix. See terms of use.
Did I just win that new car over there?
No, I did.
The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and their guests on the Original Talk Radio Network are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Original Talk Radio Network, its management, staff, advertisers, associates, or affiliated stations.
Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
I want to go back to something that I put together for you months back, and I don't remember when, but it was called Obama and the Shadow Socialist Group Behind Egypt's Fall by Michael Savage. Barack Obama, I said, has been playing a critical role in making sure that Egypt, one of our staunchest allies in the Middle East, is positioned to become the next member of the Union of Iranian Radical Islamist Republics headed by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Every single word out of the president's mouth, every single move he's made, has had the effect of stabbing Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in the back, of opening the door to Islamist radicals taking another step on their way to restoring an unholy caliphate in that region. Now, I wrote this several months ago before Mubarak was thrown out, before the Muslim Brotherhood achieved the presence that it has, before the Christians were killed, before the churches were burned. I'll continue what I wrote. The historical precedent for Obama's actions can be found in those of another weak liberal Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. In the late 1970s, I wrote, the Shah of Iran ruled that country in much the same way Hosni Mubarak has ruled Egypt, through maintaining tight control over the population with a strong military and the support of the United States. When Carter withdrew his support of the Shah in the name of, quote, human rights, he enabled the Ayatollah Khomeini to return to Iran from his exile in Paris and assume leadership of the country. It looks very much like Obama is following directly in Carter's footsteps. The problem is that the situation is much more serious today than it was 30 years ago. Blame that on Jimmy Carter. Carter's turning over Iran to the mullahs has allowed Islamist radicalism to establish a soon-to-be nuclear outpost in the region. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is set to expand his influence and power by abetting the overthrow of nations such as Egypt that retain ties with and receive support from the West. There is no doubt that Ahmadinejad sees himself as the leader of an Islamist union that wields power, that wields immense power, okay, over the entire Middle East and threatens Western civilization as well. Since the 9/11 attacks on the United States, the left in America has come out on the side of Islamist radicals. They cheered as the Twin Towers fell and American lives were lost. With the election of one of their own as president of the United States, the left moved even closer to realizing its aim of bringing down our country. It is not out of the question that Barack Obama is actually working to ensure that our allies in the Middle East, including Egypt and Jordan, follow in the footsteps of Iran in installing a radical Islamist government. It is not out of the question that Obama seeks the demise of our staunchest ally, Israel. I wrote this several months ago. What is becoming clear is that, like Jimmy Carter, Obama is on the side of Islamist radicals.
when Iranian students stage an uprising after the rigged election in that country, ensured that the totalitarian government of Ahmadinejad would remain in power, Obama was on vacation in Hawaii and threatened the Iranian insurrection and treated the Iranian insurrection as nothing more than a nuisance. Instead of intervening and speaking out strongly in favor of the students and the overthrow of a truly heinous enemy regime, Obama declined to take sides, saying, "It's up to Iranians to decide who Iran's leaders will be." By not speaking out and taking the lead in denouncing the Iranian regime, Obama revealed where his sympathies lay. Only a few weeks earlier, Obama had delivered one of his more insipid speeches. Speaking in Cairo, he had called for America to end torture and close the prison at Guantanamo Bay in order to reclaim its, quote, moral authority. Obama's insistence that the people of Iran should decide who their leaders are simply ignored the fact that the Ahmadinejad regime had rigged the election. The point was that there was no way the Iranian people could decide who the leaders would be. By saying what he did, Obama came down solidly on the side of the Muslim dictatorship and rigging elections in order to achieve it. Less than 2 years later, the Cairo insurrection against one of America's staunchest allies, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, provided Obama with another chance to speak out against Islamist radicalism. Instead, he's again waffled and backtracked and stabbed Mubarak in the back by demanding that the Egyptian president step down immediately. Incidentally, he's out already. Nobody is saying that Mubarak's government is a paragon of democratic rule. What Mubarak has done, though, is to provide a stabilizing influence in the Middle East. He's the closest thing to a friend that Israel has in the region. He's helped Israel secure its borders, and he's kept the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood from gaining power in Egypt by outlawing them. Let me pause. That's yesterday. Today it's over. It's over now. So where did all of this come from? Let me speed up to the next point in my article, and I will show you that the handwriting was on the wall, and it comes all the way from George Soros all over again. It's the very man who engineered the financial meltdown of our country, who enabled Obama to get elected in the first place. Once again, the fingerprints of George Soros are all over this.
Savage.
Give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire.
The whole culture is just completely out of whack. It's like the earth tilted on its axis. Okay, the earth has tilted on its axis. The earth of our morality, the earth of our ethics, the earth of our national identity has been moved off its axis. How it can ever be reset, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. I have some ideas. I want to play for you something in a minute. I showed you how we've gone from men like Jonas Salk to Anthony Weiner, and comparing a Jewish to a Jew. We compared a Martin Luther King Jr. to a rapper. We compared Edward R. Murrow to a man who says he got a chill up his leg on MSNBC while listening to Obama, a softball. And you look at Jonas Salk, born in 1914, died in 1995. He was an American medical researcher. I'm going to tell you something you may not know about him. He was the first, he discovered and developed the first safe and effective polio vaccine, right? Now, I lived through the fear of the early 50s when polio was an epidemic and everyone was afraid to go in swimming pools and they didn't know where the virus came from. It was a national nightmare in this country. And until 1955, when the Salk vaccine was introduced, polio was the most frightening public health problem of the post-war United States. And when news of the vaccine success was made public on April 12, 1955, Salk was hailed as a miracle worker. The day almost became a national holiday. It frankly should be instead of Cesar Chavez Day. But we'll put that aside for a minute. Instead of a vegetable picker, it should have been Jonas Salk Day. But Salk's sole focus had been to develop a safe and effective vaccine as quickly as possible, with no interest in personal profit. Listen to the tale at the end of the story. When he was asked in a televised interview who owned the patent to the polio vaccine, you know what Jonas Salk said? Quote, "There is no patent. Could you patent the sun?" Now compare Jonas Salk to the current crop of biomedical researchers and doctors who are doing research today anywhere in the world. There are none left. It's a product of the time as well. Greed. Greed rules.
Savage.
From the White House to the junk house in one administration. How the Obamas have degraded the presidency in the White House. Let me begin by saying that last night I watched a TV movie after a hard day on the radio and exactly one vodka cocktail. Frankly, I was spent. I searched around and I fell into a movie about a woman with two teenage children who was divorced and meets an apparently nice guy in a hardware store and begins a relationship with him. Now, her son is 16 years old. He returns from military school. He's living in the house. He starts to suspect that the man may be bad. Then he suspects he may be a serial killer based upon certain things that happen in the plot. The woman, though, is in total denial throughout the entire story. No matter what the son discovers, she keeps denying that this, quote, nice guy she met is a serial killer, that there's nothing wrong with him, that the guy makes her happy, and she wishes her son would stop with his paranoia and his suspicions. But as the plot unfolds, and as we see what this new man does, he actually is shown to be a serial killer. He kills an elderly neighbor who has seen a picture of him on America's Most Wanted. He then kills one of the women's friends who asked for his ID and he won't give it to her after a small job in her real estate firm. Eventually, the guy's mania shows and he tries to kill the whole family. Now, the point I'm making is this. Obama is like the smiling, nice guy that women meet in the hardware store. They took him into their confidence, while behind the scenes, he continues to rape and destroy everything that is valuable and decent and good about America. He is literally destroying the house. And while the women of America who actually elected him were gulled a first time by his good looks and his smooth voice, you would think the women of America would not be gulled a second time. You would think that after Obamacare, the Stimulus Act, the takeover of General Motors, the pandering to the radical Islamists, all of the other incredible disasters that this man has brought upon this nation, from the destruction of the currency, the wreckage of the economy, the joblessness, $5 a gallon gasoline, you would think the women of America would finally see the true face of this president and who he really is. But I'm afraid that just like the woman in the movie, the women of America are just as gullible, and Mr. Obama will continue to destroy until he makes one fatal mistake.
Savage.
Howie on line five, go ahead, please.
Michael, it's your long-lost cousin. I haven't spoken to you in quite a while, and
Howie,
I'm in the middle
Wait a minute. This is the Howie, the relative?
That's right.
Wait a minute. Your wife, my cousin, let you call me?
No, she's not here.
she's out Howie, I always liked you. You're always my favorite relative.
She's out to an engagement party tonight. So
yeah, but wait. But you, Howie, you're the ex-Navy guy who actually is a conservative. You're the only conservative in that entire part of the family. What? You know she doesn't listen to my show.
She used to when I played it so loud because I'm a little deaf nowadays.
Oh.
So, like, she hears it through the other rooms.
You're a great guy. I'm sending you another copy of Abuse of Power for your lovely wife. Stay on the line. It's funny. He just calls, and he says to me he has hearing loss. He's deaf. And here's my ad from Envoy Medical, one of my advertisers, and it's about this. It's amazing. Because look at the ad. Look what it says. Because as you age, you focus more on the legacy you leave your children and grandchildren. And to share your wisdom and experience with your kids and grandkids is one of life's most important callings. It's true. But what if you suffer from hearing loss? Well, you could lose this gift. Leaving that legacy requires effective two-way communication. And there's a medical breakthrough now for those with hearing loss, Howie, called the Esteem Hearing Implant. This revolutionary solution is 100% invisible, so you can keep up your active lifestyle. The Esteem Hearing Implant delivers a natural improvement to your hearing, Howie, with a natural clarity of sound. Learn about this new breakthrough and give your children a legacy they will cherish for a lifetime. Okay, I want you to call 1-800. Can you hear me now? 1-800-953-5453 or envoymedical.com. Did you get it? 800-953-5453 or envoymedical.com. Do it today. 1-800-953-5453 or envoymedical.com. For a list of side effects and benefits associated with steam, visit envoymedical.com.
Savage.
is the phone number, michaelsavage.com. We're also talking about, on the greatest talk show in the history of America, the American Taliban, who I affectionately call Rat Boy, John Walker Lind, whose father wrote an editorial in the New York Times saying that now that Osama bin Laden's dead, it's time for them to release Rat Boy. I say, yeah, sure, President Obama, release Rat Boy, and he can come home the day, you know who comes home, right? Yeah, you can release him.
Absolutely. It's time to release him. He can come home when Mr. Spann, when John Michael Spann comes home. When Johnny comes marching home again, Rat Boy can come home again as far as I'm concerned. I want to play for you a little history here. I'm going to play three clips of American Taliban John Walker Lynn's parents going back to 2007. First Mama Taliban, Marilyn Walker.
Given the temperature in the country at the time after 9/11, I could understand it. People were angry. They were confused. There was a lot of pain.
Here's the guy to blame.
Let's blame him. I mean, it's not rational. I don't think it was a rational thing, but, you know.
Let's stop right there. Now, here's the mother who left her husband, converted to Buddhism, and I don't have to tell you what an American is who becomes a Buddhist. Americans are to Buddhism, I'll finish the analogy another time. They think that by putting their hands together and sitting on a mat, they become a Buddhist. Ask a real Buddhist what they think of Americans mocking Buddhism, and you'll understand what I think about most of these frauds. But she says, you're stupid. You were angry. You were confused by 9/11. You really didn't know who did it. You were full of pain. It was irrational to blame her poor son. Although he converted to Islam, he took terrorist training. He was found in a firefight with an AK-47 hiding like a rat in the bottom of a basement. You were confused, and it's irrational to blame him because he wasn't a real traitor. Now listen to what the rest of the clip has. You won't believe this gold that we found.
Didn't have anywhere else to put it.
But it was like a nightmare for us as a family, because we know John. We know he's not anti-American. We know he doesn't have any sympathy for terrorism. And yet here he stood accused of these things in the public eye, in the media.
Hold on. Let's stop for a minute. You know, Mr. Lind, you can't mean what you just said. He doesn't support terrorism. And yet he's accused of these things. Well, let me remind you of something, Mr. and Mrs. Lind, about your wonderful son who grew up in Marin County, whose brain was poisoned by the liberalism of the schools out here. Your rat son attended a training camp for military training. Your rat son traveled to the Al-Farouq training camp, a facility associated with Osama bin Laden. Your rat son in June of July of 01 remained at the Al-Farouq camp and participated fully in its training activities, including courses in weapons, orienteering, navigation, explosives, and battlefield combat. These facts that I'm reading you come directly by Lind and his attorney that he signed on his sentencing. He said, having sworn allegiance to jihad in or about July or August 01 after completing his training, the defendant traveled to Kabul, Afghanistan to assist the Taliban. In or about July or August 2001, the defendant carried an AKM rifle issued by the Taliban while he traveled together with approximately 150 non-Afghan fighters from Kabul to the front line in Takhir in northeastern Afghanistan. Between about September and November 2001, John Walker Lynn Ratboy, his defendant's fighting group, was divided into smaller groups and rotated in 1 to 2 week shifts in the Takhar trenches opposing Northern Alliance troops. In other words, Ratboy admitted to having trained in a camp run by Osama bin Laden and having fought with the wonderful Taliban, fought with them. The son also admitted he carried an AKM rifle and grenades. And yet in 2002, his demented father compared his son to Nelson Mandela, which just shows you how little the lawyer's words can be trusted. While Frank Lynn writes that his son is intelligent, spiritual, good-natured, he expects you to believe his son was so clueless that he did not really understand that he was training under and fighting for the man who ordered the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And apparently, the Lynn people apparently think that John Walker Lynn had no responsibility in warning U.S. forces about the prison attack that led to the death of CIA operative Johnny Mike Spann. Spann's father disgraces the name Truth. And I think that, yes, your son should come home. As I said, sure he should come home. When Michael Spann comes home, he can come home.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Chicago. Bruce, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I appreciate your dedication and work. And I just want to ask your opinion, when you have sinus congestion, cold, and trying to get over it, using a neti pot.
You know, you ask the wrong person. These hippie... let's start with this. I mean, I am an expert at herbal medicine. I've written books on homeopathy and such, and I do believe to a certain extent in alternative medicine. So let's frame it that way. However, when it comes to sticking a neti pot with salt water into my nostril and having it run all over my clothing, I mean, there's a limit to how far into the third world healing I am willing to go. If you're interested in using something in your nostrils because of sinus congestion that's a little less dramatic, I would suggest buying a little salt water, you know, the saline sprays in a drugstore.
Yep.
Or, for that matter, you can mix salt water in your own house and inhale it. It'll run down your throat and all over your neck anyway. The neti pot thing is very, very Nelly. It's very Nelly, I'm sorry. You've tried it with the spout in the nostril?
I haven't tried it yet. I was told about it and didn't know if it was going to be anything.
There's something icky about the neti pot that I can't get into. I mean, if I were to use a neti pot on a clogged nostril, it would have to be in a bathtub. It's going to run all over your neck, down on your lip. I mean, do you want, like, mucus on your neck? You know, the reason they could use it in India is that they basically don't believe in dry cleaning, number one. And number two, they could do it while they're swimming in the Ganges River. You know, take your neti pot and go have a bath in the Ganges. But it's not made for Westerners who are sitting in a normal environment who basically want to wear a white shirt and tie in the morning, you know. But look, to each his own. Today in America, anything goes, including neti pots, I suppose. Andy in Chicago. Is that Jandy or Andy? My eyes are blurry. Andy. Andy, what's on your mind, Andy?
You know, it's a curse when people call you with stuff like that because you're so graphic. I'm just cringing in my car. So,
no, I have a gift with words, but if he's going to ask me about a neti pot, what can I say to him other than there's a certain limit to how much into the third world I'm going to go? I do not want mucus from my nose all over my collar, no.
But it's just horrible the way you describe it. It's like I'm sitting in my car and it's real. Stop yourself. Hey, I want to talk about gardening. First of all, I have two dogs that are diggers. I don't have a lot to. I need to pot plant in a pot, and also more importantly, I don't want to know what you're planting this year.
I planted tomatoes, Italian parsley, basil, and I have a bunch of fruit trees. However, almost all my fruit trees are infected with a fungal disease this year, which is common now in the San Francisco Bay Area. They all have a curly leaf disease, which is caused by a countywide fungus. So unfortunately, the trees are being sprayed. We are spraying them with an organic spray, so the fruit will still be useful, but it's pretty horrible to see that.
Well, how about something that maybe you could plant? I have a 9-year-old daughter who wants to plant carrots, and I have two dogs that love to dig.
Carrots are good, but, you know, I don't know. Do you cook? So Italian parsley is nice to plant. I'm very impressed with the pots that they give you now that come out of nurseries, which have they're like an earth pot that you can put right in the ground. Have you seen them? They're amazing.
No.
You gently tear the bottom of the pot off. They have the seedlings in them, right? And you gently tease off the bottom of the pot, which is sort of a compost paper type of pot. And then you pull out the tendrils very delicately. You tease them out. You dig a hole. You put the whole pot right in the ground. It's got pre-fertilized. And this is the most amazing thing that they've developed. So it's almost impossible to screw up having something grow. I mean, I planted my tomatoes out here in California in very late March. I prefer planting them in early March, but they were not available. You want to get the tomatoes in by early April, the latest, on the West Coast. But you're in Chicago, which is just the right time for you, right?
Right. Right now, I mean, we got a little bit of weather and, you know, Mother's Day, so I'm going to put my wife to work planting.
Yeah, but, you know, plants are amazing for children because I remember as a kid, you talk about graphic. I remember in the third, fourth grade, they had us grow lima beans. Kids don't know the first thing about reality. When we sprouted lima beans and I saw a shoot come out of it, I was astounded to understand that inherent in a bean was life itself. In other words, the whole concept of living foods came home to me crystal clear. It's a beautiful thing to teach your children how to plant things.
That's what she learned was when we planted a bean, you know how the bean actually comes up, the shell of the bean comes out of the ground on the plant. That's what actually got her very, very excited about it.
That's right, and it takes the child's mind away from the computer and away from the fantasy on the computer into the reality of the earth. There's really nothing better.
I'm 100% for little, even gardens and cities. You could do them in windowsills if you got sunlight and you keep up the watering, you can do them there. But I don't want to do a gardening show. I mean, gardening is nice. It's not like my whole life. It's just beautiful. That's something Michelle Obama and I share, is a love for vegetable gardens. Oh, here we go. Another neti pot call. Just what I need. Okay, if you got disgusted by the last neti pot call, I'd recommend that you put it on mute for a minute. Frankie in Chicago, go ahead, please.
You know, the neti pot thing, my mother says, oh, my boyfriend uses a neti pot. Try it. It works. All it did was irritate my mucous membranes more. Not only did it do that.
Why are so many American men suddenly sticking teapots in their nose?
I have no idea. But
What did the Indians run out of a market for teapots, so they came up with this neti pot concept?
It just doesn't make sense.
I mean, next they'll sell them for, shall I say, ears. They'll call it an ear. You get an earache, stick the neti pot in your ear. They'll work your way down the body.
Yeah, the whole allergy thing. I understand people's problems with allergies, and they're looking for alternatives. But as far as taking salt, basically, it's pouring it into the...
Well, all right, now let's start. Salt water is very therapeutic for irritated sinus cavities, incidentally. It's just a matter of whether or not you want to... apply it using a neti pot or just simply buy a little spray at a drugstore. I mean, I prefer the more, let us say, westernized approach, which is a little bottle of saline solution.
The amount, you know, though, they tell you to put in there.
Oh, it's horrible. No, it's disgusting till it runs in the back. It's graphically disgusting. This is something that I have to cut off at a certain point, because once it goes in the back of your throat, you can't ever eat food again. Nothing ever tastes right. Once you let's cut it off right there, because I can get even more graphic, and I don't really mean to, just for shock value. You want to talk about peach trees or Osama bin Laden? Sacramento, Terry, go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, stop with the pots. Yeah, your peaches have peach leaf curl that has nothing to do with the Bay Area. It's all over California fruit orchards this year because all the rain we had. And the best thing you can do is just keep your trees healthy, put compost, or I don't do organic, fertilize them to get those leaves growing.
Oh, so in other words, even if we spray them, it's the fruit's shot.
Yeah, well, your fruit's not shot. You got to get your leaves growing again. If you get some fertilizer on them, it'll shoot.
What do you mean? You're saying that they were overwatered from the heavy rains this winter?
No, there's a fungus that's endemic in California. It's there every year. And it's exacerbated by a lot of rainfall. So I'm over in the Fresno County area where there's we have 100,000 acres of peach trees there, and there's guys that have done everything, myself included, and I have peach leaf curl. And what you do is you just grow the tree out of it. But next winter, make sure you put a dormant spray on it, a copper Bordeaux that kills that fungus in the dormancy.
I get it. So what should I do right now? What are you saying? Just keep the tree healthy with fertilizer and let it grow itself out is what you're suggesting.
It's going to drop all those leaves, and what you need to do is just put just light fertilizer every couple of weeks. So if you're doing the organic thing, get fish emulsion or whatever those guys say to use.
No, oh, God, I got to go kill fish and grind them into the fish powder. All right, well, good. Thanks for the tip. You're an actual farmer. That's good enough for me. I had prize apricots. I have a small hillside orchard in one of my properties, and it was a prize 25-year-old apricot orchard when I bought it. And I'll tell you, each year it's gotten worse.
Savage.
Sacramento, California. Lance, you're on the Savage Nation.
Oh, Mike, I love it when you're in a mood like this. Thank you very much for the literature excursion. I wanted to vote in favor of it, and just back from Europe for 6 weeks.
So Lance, what were you doing in Europa?
Well, I roamed around Portugal and Spain, beat the pee out of a Mitsubishi rental car. And
so you're like a young guy on the big trip to Europe?
I'm a senior fool, gray hair, speeding on the...
Oh, you're an old guy who sounds young. You're doing like the air-conditioned nightmare trip to Europe.
We used to joke about it. When I was at Queens College, 17, we had nothing. And we used to, a guy who said to me, you know what, I'm leaving college. He said, I'm going to go to Europe and become a writer. He said, I don't want to wait till I'm old at 40, he said, and I'm going to go visit Europe in an air-conditioned Chrysler. That was the joke.
Oh, it was an air-conditioned Mitsubishi, but we didn't stay in air-conditioned hotels. It was all bottom-line stuff and toll.
Did you enjoy Portugal, though? You know, it's a funny thing. I've wanted to go to Portugal, a once-great empire. It reminds me of, well, I like ex-empires. There's something dramatically beautiful about fallen empires. Is Portugal, I understand Lisbon is somewhat like San Francisco, built up on hills.
Lisbon is a beautiful city, but of course it's just as dangerous as any other beautiful city. But the place I would really recommend that you go is the so-called Douro Valley. It's this river valley that has grapevines planted in it. It's the region from which port wines come from. And it is spectacularly beautiful there around the...
How's the food in Portugal?
Cannot complain. If you know what you're ordering, you will get quality food. They have...
I would imagine they're heavy on the calamari and seafood.
Absolutely. They've got the seafood, and they know what to do with a pig.
No, so do we. I think that you have to give the Navy SEALs credit for that as well.
Absolutely. Now, Michael, be careful. Don't get banned in Portugal, because I'm pretty sure you want to go there.
Okay. I'll make certain that I don't say anything negative about port wine, which I'm not a fan of, by the way. You know, the origin of port wine is very interesting. It was wine that was ruined through a long sea voyage. It's basically corked wine. How does that become good wine? How could anyone confuse corked wine, meaning port wine, with high-end wine? Why do people like it?
Well, I'm going to explain. I learned something about this. In fact, you're right about this brandy business. So what they did was they intentionally, to make this not in the cask, they stopped the fermentation with brandy so that the wine is still sweet. It doesn't become ultra-dry wine like we tend to do in the...
I can't drink. See, I don't like Madeira wines at all. I get sick from them. I can only drink super-dry wine. That's another reason I don't like port wine. I cannot stand malolactic fermented wine either. I get nauseated from the Chardonnays in California, which they've turned into like vanilla soda in order to please the young woman's taste.
Okay, well,
I grew up, as though I didn't have a lot of money, I sure had good taste. I grew up on Chablis number one and Grand Cru Chablis. When the first few dollars I had as a teacher, I used to drink Santé Million with dinner on my own in a little restaurant on 10th Avenue and 40-something Street, which is long gone. I'd sit alone and get half a bottle of Santé Million. You're talking about tart, tannic wine? That's the only kind of wine I can drink.
They're making that now. They've decided that it shouldn't all go to port. They have ultra-high-quality grapes there with all kinds of special varietals that are almost unique to Portugal. And they aren't using them to make port all the time anymore. They're making top-quality, cask-aged, oak cask.
All right. Well, the wine wouldn't be the reason I would go to Portugal. I'd go for other reasons. You know, one of the things I've wanted to see in Portugal, I saw a picture years ago that has stuck in my mind, which is of these high-walled estates from when Portugal was a great empire and there were great fortunes. These families have been rich for 200 years or more. They live behind 20-foot walls. Is that still true? Was there a section like that?
Well, I didn't go to that part of Lisbon, but I toured the castles on the Sintra Hill. Of particular interest is the highest one, the Peña Castle.
I mean, because I love in America, you can't have a wall higher than 6 feet. You hear this?
Yes.
A 6-foot wall is all they let you build. You hear, in this day and age, you have to go to some schmuck bureaucrat. He gives you permission to build a 6-foot wall. That's really protective against a kid who can jump over an 8-foot wall with one leap.
Well, look, Mike, if you want a higher wall, move to Pakistan.
It just shows you what a high wall does for you, huh, when they come in from the air.
Oh,
yeah. Well, I'm not Osama bin Laden. I'm not in that category of fear. Thanks for the call and for the compliments. I really appreciate it. Nice call. See, that is conversation when you can go from a philosophical blah, 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 all the way into port wine. That's called conversation. Remember this, okay? The word conversation means with verse, conversation. And what does that mean? The purpose of conversation is to keep the conversation going. And unfortunately, because of a distortion in our culture, we think that the object of a conversation is to cut the other man off and make him into a fool. And that's where you get the morons on television like Bill Maher. Let me tell you this. Cut off. In other words, book a Republican Schmendrick on with five schmuck liberals and make him look like a moron and think that makes you smart. That's not conversation. That's stupidity. It's the same thing with all of these late night comedians. They write these one-liners meant to entrap somebody. It's not intelligent. It's not wise. It's not even fun to listen to. Okay? What we just had on this show, what we're having right now, is conversation. It's something I specialize in. I'm a Renaissance man. In some regards, it's an old word, but it has meaning. If you have knowledge, if you've read a lot, if you've traveled a bit and you're a bit of a depressive as I am, it's very easy to do.
Savage.
The U.S. knew as early as 2008 that groups opposed to the Mubarak regime were already developing a plan to overthrow the Egyptian government. Now, I want to pause there. Remember how the media played it? That it was spontaneous, that it was young people with dungarees and blackberries who simply got together on a rave in the street? Nonsense. This was plotted and planned. And I can prove it. And I wrote a 16-page article on it. These are activists who were trained in the United States of America. They were trained by radicals in the United States of America. And so, therefore, this was not spontaneous the way the vermin in the media would have painted the portrait. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at it, when you try to establish a democracy in the Middle East, Islamist radicals move in and take over, I wrote. It's exactly what happened in Gaza in the elections of 2005. The terrorist group Hamas was the big winner over Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah party. By 2007, Hamas had driven the Fatah party out of Gaza. And when Abbas, still the nominal president of Gaza, called for elections in January of 2009, Hamas said that anyone who participated in the election would be dealt with by the Hamas ministry or by other means. In other words, if you vote, you die. So that's what the term free elections means in the Middle East. It means that a radical terrorist organization will move in, intimidate the population, and make sure that its candidates are elected. It's exactly what is likely to happen in Egypt, I wrote, even if a, quote, orderly transition to free elections takes place. And I go on, and I don't want to repeat it again. But who is behind this is the question. I can't spell it all out for you again, but I want you to understand that this did not happen on its own. There are fingerprints of Soros, there are fingerprints of Brzezinski, there are fingerprints of Jimmy Carter's group, in other words, all over this. And I will go back only to that point so that you understand that I'm not making this up out of whole cloth. We go to al-Baradei, who showed up in Cairo only 2 days after the uprising began and was immediately named a negotiator by the Muslim Brotherhood. I wrote, in fact, al-Baradei had been waiting in the wings for quite a while. You see, al-Baradei, I wrote, is on the board of an organization headed by George Soros and Zbigniew Brzezinski, called International Crisis Group. Brzezinski is the same man who supervised the fall of the Shah of Iran in 1979. Another board member of the ICC is Javier Solana. Solana is one of the most powerful figures in the European Union. And because of his Marxist sympathies and his support for the regime of Cuba's Fidel Castro, Solana was once on the USA's subversive list. Former USA National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, who once smuggled incriminating documents out of the Clinton White House by hiding them in his clothing, is another board member, as is General Wesley Clark, once fired from his NATO command. Mohammed al-Baradei also sits on the ICC's board. So, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand this is a conspiracy of the New World Order. It is it's true Obama is the man giving the speech, but Soros is exerting influence on all of the policies and pronouncements of Barack Obama and his administration. And his influence includes promoting the Muslim Brotherhood to a position of power in Egypt. I will go on at another time. I don't like reading articles on the show because I know that talk radio is supposed to be a spontaneous medium, and I'm very good at spontaneity. However, when it comes to a situation as serious as this, with such implications as what happened today, I ask you to read the entire article. It's 16 pages long. It's entitled Obama and the Shadow Socialist Group Behind Egypt's Fall. And it was written, several months ago before Mubarak was actually thrown out. But you have to understand these things didn't happen on their own volition like the vermin in the media would have you believe.
Savage. Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised. America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me.
We all need relief. We need a couple hours of relief every day. We're all going to crack up from the stress of living under this incompetent administration. We don't know which way to turn. That's the truth. That's what it comes down to. Everybody wants a laugh. Everybody wants just a breather. Yesterday in the middle, like in the late afternoon, I go to a certain place. I'm not going to tell you where it is. And they have Latin dancing. So it's like, you know, Cuban style that I grew up on in New York. But thankfully, thank God, it's come to my home county. It's not late at night with the drug addicts. It's in the middle of the afternoon, which was more typical of how it used to be done and how it's done in Latin American countries. I don't understand is going to a dance club at 10 o'clock at night. Don't these people work? I don't understand it. Who can dance at 10 o'clock till 5 in the morning and go to work other than someone with a menial job? So I didn't go for years. So now this place, I heard a band last night. They're Ecuadorian. They were fantastic. All of the great pachanga, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I hung out there, so I don't know anybody there. I go up by myself, and I hang out alone. And a guy comes up to me, and he says, loves my show. And another guy comes up. He says, Mike, he's a musician. He said, I'm a retired Air Force officer, lieutenant colonel, blah, 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 love the show. And these guys are all into music and dancing. And some of these people are great dancers. So one word led to the other, and all of the guys started to tell each other that I was there. And then the owner, who's Italian, you know, really got into talking with me about his food, which is Tuscan, which is very strange, the combination, how good the food is, I mean. And he invited me to be, you're not going to believe this in a million years, right, where I'm coming from. He invited me to be a dance judge for next week at a Latin dance judge. I said, what do you mean? I know what I like. He said, no, I want you to judge the dance contest next week. I said, I don't know how to judge a dance contest. He said, please come here and be a judge next week at the dance contest. I said, all right, I'll be a judge next week at the dance contest. He says, whatever you want, I'll get you a bottle of Dom Perignon. I said, please don't buy me anything. I don't want anything. I come here to enjoy the music and basically be left alone. So that was, you know, what's going on, blah, blah, blah. So a guy comes up to me. And he starts talking to me, and he said he fought in the war in Israel in 1967. He was a man, maybe. He must be in his 60s. I don't know how old he is. And he was on the front lines. And he said to me, he comes to a place like this to get away from the world for a couple of hours. He says, you know what? You gotta enjoy life while you can. You know the old basic stuff we've all heard. In other words, enjoy yourself, have a good time, escape reality with the dance, with the music, with women, whatever, right? But a healthy person can do this and then go back to the reality of their life. An unhealthy person needs the suspension of reality 24/7. So let's say they go to the dance club. Well, then they need to get high. Then after they get through with the dance club, they need to stay high. Then they need to get up in the morning and be high again. Do you know what I'm saying? That's the difference between being able to live in reality and have some fun and not being able to live in reality and going for that fun. So there's an article attached to this. We're talking about people who are drug addicted or addicted on their own ego. And the article came out today. It says, pre-adulthood separates the men from the boys. And it's a long article. It says, once upon a time in America, boys became men when they went to war or started a family. And it said those milestones still hold true. But there's an article out, how the rise of women has turned men into boys. And they say too many young men today are stuck in a stage of extended adolescence. And they'd rather hang around home and choose video games or watch the Cartoon Network over adult responsibility. And he says there simply never has been this large a percentage of single young people with so few family responsibilities and lots of entertainment. And he's talking about what was going on in the old days. And he goes back to the 50s. He said in the 50s, most people completed the transition to adulthood, finishing school, finding their first job, marrying and having children by age 21 or so. But he says, but times have changed dramatically. And he says, my students today, they're going to live, if demographers are right, into their mid-90s. So they look at me and they say, now wait, get married at age 20? I'm not sure I want to be married to the same person for 76 years. And they have a point. And he says, young single adulthood is a stage of development. It's not going away. So I'm going to ask you a question, because they're arguing that it's very hard right now to get a job. Listen to what they say. It's much harder to find your way into your first good job, says Heimowitz, and takes longer still to move to the next professional level. And then they say, in this new economy, young people will take much, much longer to grow up. Do you agree that that's the reason, because it's hard to find a job? I don't think that's the reason at all. When was it ever easy to find a job in America? When I graduated college, it was very hard to find a job. It was never easy. Nothing has ever been easy. You mean it was easier for your great-grandfather living somewhere in Europe with 5, 10 children or whatever they had over there, scratching a living out of the earth? It was easier for him? So it's all a lie. There's some other reason that boys won't become men. What is the reason that boys won't become men? Do you think it's because women have turned into men themselves? He's saying the rise of women has turned men into boys. We know that more women have college degrees. We know that more women are more aggressive than ever before. We know that women look like men, act like men, talk like men, have the morals of men. And so many men don't even want to get married. They don't go out with women. They don't want to get married. What's the point of getting married when they go out and meet someone, have a roll in the hay, so to speak, without getting married? Do you think it's because of women's liberation that men are staying as boys? Do you think it's because of the sexual revolution of the 60s? What exactly do you think is the reason so many men won't get married? Why do you think so many men remain boys, if you want to put it to you that way?
You know what's been coming back to me? No, this is too personal. Because they brought up bullying. I had like flashbacks. I'm supposed to remember everything that was ever done. It all came back to me in a flood. I had an anxiety attack because Obama talked about having big ears, and that even he, you know, he almost broke out a tissue, started crying about being bullied. So I remembered. I remember what they did. I remember distinctly what happened, and I wish I knew the teacher's name. I'd dig him up from the grave if I could find him. You talk about a pervert. You want to hear a story? Jamaica High School. What year? Oh, I don't know. 55, 56? I was a young kid. I was 2 years ahead because of the birth date, and I skipped the grade, and I was small. I was not big. So here I am in the 10th grade, the second year. I skipped. I don't know how old I must have been. 14? I don't even know. Yeah, I graduated high school at 16, I think. I don't remember. I was really 13 and a half in a sophomore in high school, right? So, and I was a small kid. Now, you got kids already in that school who are 18, 19, left behind. They're fully grown like thugs. Do you know what they did to the people? You want to hear a story? Jamaica High School? I want the gym teacher's name. They made us get undressed to go swimming in the swimming pool. It was freezing. There was no heated pool. There was no heat in the swimming pool area. Big deal. All right, sir. Okay, understand. That wasn't. But they made you strip down naked. Now, you say, why would they make a kid swim without trunks in a high school in those days? Do you have any idea what that does to a kid who's on the younger side when there's older kids there? And I know the teacher was a perv. I know the way he behaved with the boys in the gym. I know who he was. I can almost remember his name. All right, get in the pool, guys. It was one of those. All right. And he would slap you with towels. This guy was a sicko. He should be in jail for 1,000 years. I hope his family's listening. I would like to look into that year, that gym teacher. I'd like to see him disinterred and put on trial, his corpse put on trial for what he did to all the kids in that school. All right, guys, get in the pool now. Let's go. Let's get in. He made believe he was one of the guys, you know, slapping the towel on your behind. Come on, let's get going there. The guy was a mainstream pervert. Sick. Sick. So what am I supposed to do, cry over it? I'm going to get up there and give a speech? But look what happens. You see, when you have a weakling for a president who's now pandering to weaklings around the world and acting like a weak, he's acting like a weak president, talking about bullying instead of talking about being a president and acting like one. Oh, and I was hurt because of my big ears. So actually it triggers in sensitive individuals your own sensitivities.
Savage.
why are so many boys stuck in boyhood? Why do so many guys in their 20s and 30s, basically, why are they still like children? What's causing this? Is it that the aggressive nature of, is it because of the aggressive nature of women? Is it because of the women's movement? Is it because for 30 years there's been propaganda that men are unnecessary? Why is this? Why are there so few men? And especially, by the way, this is a very difficult thing to point out, but it's a demographic reality. Caucasian men in particular are wimps, young men. You don't see this as much amongst the Latino men. Many of the Latino men will get married young and have families. You don't see this as much amongst other races. You see it primarily amongst Caucasian men in the West. Why is it that they remain Boy Scouts instead of becoming Scoutmasters? Why are so many men, shall I say males, let's put it to you that way, stuck in boyhood? Why is it that they didn't do what probably you did if you're part of my generation, getting married relatively young, struggling, having children very young, basically killing yourself very young to have a family? Now, what motivated people of my generation to do that? I'm going to lay down a couple of ideas that I have, and then I'm going to ask you your ideas. For one, when I was a young man, I knew what was expected of me. There was no question. My parents, my relatives let me know very clearly that a male in our society should go to college, get a career, find a girl, pick one out of the chorus line, get married and have children, or else there were questions about you. There were questions about you in every way. Like, what's wrong with you that you can't get married? I mean, if you hit 30 and you weren't married already, forget about it. You know what I'm saying? You had to meet someone, get married, and have children. You say, well, that was the dark ages. Really? Hey, schmuck, I'd like to say to you, if it wasn't for guys like your father, you wouldn't be here. Think about what I just said to you. If it wasn't for the so-called dark ages, you wouldn't be here. If your father behaved the way you are, you wouldn't be here. Don't you understand that? So what exactly is going on in our society that so many white men, so many white males are afraid to become men, in plain English? In plain English, that's all. What is doing it? What happened? Why are they so boy-like instead of men? What happened to this country? And there are many answers, by the way. There's not a single answer. So let's start with the callers. I've given you one little example. I think there are others. I mean, we could blame it on Hollywood. We could blame it on the women's movement. We could blame it on medication. We could blame it on the drinking water. We could blame it on a lot of things. And there's probably an element of truth in all of that. There are hormones in our foods that have feminized men, by the way. You say, oh, you know, it's right-wing stuff. No, it's true, well-known. There are plastics that mimic hormones that are turning men into kind of like guppies. And that's been documented. But that's not the sole reason that a lot of men won't get married. They do date girls. They have a lot of sex. There's a lot of sex out there, and that has something to do with it, too. The women aren't holding it back anymore. They're like guys. I'm equal to a guy, so I'll have as many men as I want sexually. Oh, good, so that's why you're not married? Get back to me when you're 35, 40. Tell me what happens then. So what's doing this, that so many white males in particular are unwilling to become men? Ann Arbor, Michigan. Barry, we'll start with you. What's your opinion? How come so many white males are stuck in boyhood?
I'm going to hazard a guess, but I think from my experience, you hear in a white male community, I don't even want to say that, sorry. You hear what you should make when you take a job. And I think that's elevated.
What you're saying, okay, you're saying the employment expectations are so high that people don't meet up to it and they feel inadequate?
And they hold out or they wait until they get that job that they think they should be getting.
And haven't they ever heard about starting at the bottom and working your way up?
No, I think many of them haven't.
I think that's a very big point. I think it's a very true point. I mean, I know it's true. A lot of young people have the idea that they are too good for menial jobs. Oh, I'm too good for retail, man. After I get home, there's nothing left. So I'll just stay home and sponge off Obamacare till I'm 27. Thanks for the call. So that's one. I mean, I got out of college. I wasn't particularly a good student. I didn't know where I was going. I had a few upsets along the way. I had to leave school for one semester. My father had had a heart attack. I had help run the store. So I got out. I was sort of drifting around a little bit. I took a job as a social worker because it was a very low-level, entry-level job. I took the job because at least it was a job. I lived lower than some of the welfare recipients. I had no furniture. I've told you the story. I wasn't ashamed of myself. I knew that, you know, I'll do it for a while. But you know what happens after a while is you get ashamed of yourself. You see people living better. So you have two choices at that point. You could walk around with a chip on your shoulder and hate everybody, or you could say, you know what, I want to make better of my life, and I'm going to work harder. I went back to school. I continued. Then I got a job teaching, and I went to graduate school after teaching all day till 10 o'clock at night. I did that many nights a week. So I got a master, blah, blah, blah. I kept pushing myself, pushing. And the more I did, the more ambitious I became. That's the strangest thing. And the older I got, the more ambitious I became. Would you believe it? To this day, people say to me, why don't you retire? I said, there's no such word in my vocabulary. I don't know what the word means. Retire from what to what? I don't play golf. I don't play tennis, etc. There's no such thing as retire. It doesn't mean I'm not tired a lot of the times and exhausted from overwork. I've taken on too much. I mean, I'm writing a novel. I'm writing a nonfiction book. I'm doing five shows a week. It is a little too much. The biggest battle in my life that sucked me dry, it's almost killed me, is this battle in the UK. You wouldn't believe it. It's drained me. I hate to admit it, but the liberals, in a way, have beaten me almost to the point of winning. I have to admit it to you. I have to look back over the last 2 years. I'd say the single biggest drain of my energy has been what the illegitimate former Prime Minister of England did to me, Gordon Brown, that corrupt sack of you-know-what, with his porno-making a Home Secretary, Jackie Smith. Incidentally, please go to michaelsavage.com and sign the petition to get my name off the list. Anyway, so what's your answer? Why are so many white males refusing to become men?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So why are so many white males refusing to become men? Tim on WOR, what's your answer? Why?
Lack of accountability, Michael. Without a doubt, people nowadays feel as if they're not responsible and they don't have to worry about the outcome of what they do on a daily basis. Or what
so
they
wait,
don't do.
Let me see if I follow that because I don't quite... In my own mind, I'm so overly responsible, I don't even understand what you mean. You mean the young men don't want responsibility?
No, what I'm saying is they're not being held accountable for who they are and what they do and the difference between...
Oh, in other words, mommy or daddy doesn't say, why are you acting like a boy? Why don't you get married already and be a man?
Eureka. Men are not what they used to be. And I think the feminization thing is a valid point, and I think that the drugging and the rest of it are all important issues, but the accountability...
In other words, the way I was raised, good old shame and humiliation is no longer used in child rearing.
Well, absolutely. And
well,
it
works. It's one of the best principles of child rearing that has ever been invented. You ask... You remember I did a show on the Chinese mother who's so... condemning of her children if they don't, you know, get super A's. Remember that? She said we shame our children. We yell at them. We call them names if they don't do well. That's the opposite of the white family today, isn't it?
Yep, and the nice thing about you is that you're not racist, nor am I. I have a background in psychology and sociology, and I, too, graduated from a very liberal state school, but not from California. I have since become very conservative in my ways. If you look at a black grandmother, for instance... They've basically taken over the role of what a black male should be doing as a father, and they'll do just what you're talking about. They'll do a wonderful job of putting, you know, a young black male in its place so that they know boundaries and so that they have healthy ways about them as opposed to running rampant and not knowing their way.
Interesting. The hardest act in the world is to be married and have children. Oh, no one said it's easy. Whoever said that was easy? I'll never forget the day I went into a restaurant. I first moved to California, North Beach. The guy is dead now. I don't remember that. I don't want to talk. And he had a placemat that with his own sayings on it, the old school Italian sayings. And he said, anybody can do the easy thing.
a man does the hard thing, that kind of thing. I like the guy. We got along very good because I was raised that way. Who said raising a family is supposed to be easy? Who said that having a relationship is supposed to be easy? Who said that? Where is it written? Where'd you get that idea? And we're trying to get to the reason why mainly white males remain boys so long, why they won't get married, why they won't have children. You can't entirely blame them. Take a look at the women out there. You know, I could go into this whole story, and there's no point, because then you'll accuse me of misogyny, which is as far from the truth as you could possibly get. The woman's movement, no doubt, destroyed the whole concept of family in the Western world. Now you say, well, it's too bad. Women didn't want to be broodmares. They didn't want to just be staying at home while a guy went out and had a good time and had a career and she stayed home. I understand all of that. But now take a look at where we are today. Take a look at the demographics of America, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. And you'll come to ask yourself, is this the direction you want the country to go in? Because that's the way it's going. And do you want to turn it around? Can you turn it around? What caused it? Why are so many white males remaining boys so long? Why don't they become men? Ethan in New York, you're on the Savage Nation. Give us your opinion.
I'm 26. I got a master's. I've been looking for a teaching job for the past 3 years, and I can't get married unless I'm financially stable enough. It's what I was raised.
Ethan, you said you're looking for a teaching job. You can't even get a teaching job?
Well, social studies is hard to find, especially...
No, I understand. But I'm going to ask you a tough question. Are they hiring minorities but not white males, or are you a minority?
To be honest, I haven't really seen that. I found that if anything, they're just not hiring anyone that's my age group.
Okay, because for a long while it was white males need not apply, particularly to civil service jobs. They put everybody ahead of the white male, but you're saying that's not the reason at all. There's no jobs at all.
No, I think that they.
But Ethan, would you, if you had a decent starting job, do you think you'd look to get married anyway?
Like I said, but I don't want to.
But hold it. Let's take the other side. What's in marriage? What would you want out of a marriage?
Kids, probably number one, eventually.
Kids. So you have the instinct to want to be a father.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is that still do guys still have that desire to raise children? I do see a lot of men playing with their children. They seem to enjoy themselves. I do see it. I look around. I'm not blind. But I wonder how strong an impulse that is amongst men today. Where do you get the idea? Where does a young man get the idea that being a father is a super thing to be? Being a husband is a great thing to be? Where does he get the idea? Where is he supposed to get it from? If the churches don't reinforce it, if the synagogues don't reinforce the concept of being a father or a man, where are they supposed to get it from? Hollywood? From who? Have you ever seen who writes the scripts? Who acts in them? They're not reinforcing the concept of a family. When have you last heard someone extolling, he's a family man? You know, when I was young, I would listen to the parents, directly or indirectly. I'd hear them talking, and I hear them would talk. Well, it's a different world altogether. First of all, there were parents in the house. That's number one. Number two, there were relatives who were in the neighborhood who came over, and friends of the family who came over. Every night, there was somebody in the house having coffee and cake, and they would talk. And as a young guy, who listened? I listened from another room, or I was doing my own thing, but you overheard. And you picked up a lot through the wall, so to speak. But they would always talk about various actors even sometimes, and they would say things like, oh, well, he's a family man. But they would say it with respect if they were referring to a particular actor or entertainer. They looked up to somebody who was a family man as opposed to a runaround guy, you know what I mean, that kind of thing. So as a young guy, you get the idea that getting married and having children is a respectful thing to do. Now let's compare that to today. When have you last seen a movie that extols the image of a young man struggling to get his first job, to meet a decent girl, to have a child, and to raise the child, whether you begin in your parents' house, doesn't matter. That was a European tradition for centuries, where the family would, the next generation stayed in the same house. There was nothing wrong with that. There's nothing new under the sun. No one says you have to have a separate apartment every time, you know, each generation. Stay in the same house. There's room for you. I'm sure the parents would probably like it if you don't have the money. It still goes on in most of the world. So what I'm getting at is it's not about the housing. There's something else going on here. And I don't quite know exactly what it is.
Savage.
Talk radio is not only not dead, but talk radio is very much alive. Although the midstream media has been claiming for years now that talk radio is dead, that the empty skirts who have been saying that this is a medium only for fringe extremists or old men, that talk radio is only for old men, I've proven them all wrong. Talk Radio Network and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when, 2000? Now, we all hear that the Internet is the king, and a lot of people ran to the Internet with their advertising money. Yet everyone knows that no one's been able to monetize their investment in the Internet. Nobody. You see, talk radio is a medium that you can't hide yourself easily in. You can't hide behind a mustache and such. 3 hours a day, Jerry. 3 hours a day, Jerry. Mr. Mustache on Fox. And unless you have a massive production staff who is talking for you, you're not going to get very far, right? But I don't have a massive staff. I have a very small and very good staff. And when you do talk radio right, people get to know you, people get to understand that you're a real person, and they relate to you. What I'm saying is I've proven that talk radio is a very vibrant medium today. People who listen to talk radio are more acutely aware of what's going on than the average American. Although the fraudulent elites, or shall I say the self-proclaimed drug addicts with microphones and cameras in front of their faces, laugh at you, the average listener to talk radio is far more knowledgeable politically than they would like you to believe. And by the way, listeners to talk radio vote both with their wallets and their ballots.
Savage.
Steps we can take right now to put Americans back to work and give our economy a boost. I know it, you know it, the American people know it, but the problem is there are some in Washington. There are some in Washington who don't seem to share this same sense of urgency. I'm going to keep forcing these senators to vote on common sense, paid-for jobs proposals. And I'm going to need you to help send them the message. You don't need to tell Michael Bennett. He's already on the page. But I'm going to need you guys to be out there calling and tweeting and all the stuff you do. You know, last week, for the second time this month, Republicans in the Senate blocked a jobs bill from moving forward.
Did you hear that? And it's organizations like the AARP who control these leftist politicians. AMAC is fighting back. The Association of Mature American Citizens. Your membership can help stop the left wing. Call 800-255-4199, 800-255-4199, or go to americaisrising.com, 800-255-4199, americaisrising.com. New York, Sandy, go ahead, please, your opinion.
Dr. Savage, I'm surely honored. I think there are many contributing factors, the pesticides in the water, turning the hormones more female, but I think two main reasons. First of all, yes, there are a lot of single women raising boys, and I don't think a woman can raise a boy to become a man. I think a man needs to be there. Not only that, it's not politically correct to be a man. I think that...
So you're saying young men, young guys are afraid to act like men? They're afraid that they'll be ostracized if they act gruff?
I don't think it's socially acceptable anymore, and I think that it's been a long range.
You mean because the roles have been reversed? Women are allowed to act like men, and men are acting like women?
Well, I think we've opened the gap to we've opened the door to a lot of different behaviors, but I think that I don't know. It's been sort of like a strategic movement. You know, in the 60s, men were running to Canada. They weren't holding up their end of the familial bargain. Women are attracted to strong men, at least I think so. And that's
sort of... when you say strong men, do you mean men with money? I got you there.
Well, I can't deny that. But I think even if you watch birds, it's the male. He makes the best nest. He cleans it out. The one who seems like the safer bet is the one the female.
You know, I once had
an old Russian rabbi talked to me when I was young. You know what he said to me from the old school? He said to me, he was joking with the words. He didn't speak very good English, and he said the word husband means house band.
Oh.
I said, what do you mean? He said house band. He puts a band around the house, and he holds it together. I thought that was a beautiful statement, by the way.
Well, not only that, but you take the male equation out, you factor that out. Men protect their realm. Now, if you're saying that men are not important, who do we have to protect our realm? However small, it could be just five kids and a wife in a small home. But I think that men look at the world so much differently than women do, and we can't get them confused, and it's just becoming...
Are you saying that men have become cowardly?
No, I see.
Does that summarize it all in a nutshell? If we were writing this in simplistic terms, would we say that the white male has abrogated his responsibilities to become a husband and a father because he's become cowardly?
I don't think it's cowardly. I think he's kind of giving up.
Giving up? That's interesting. That is a distinction, isn't it?
What?
He's giving up. Why? Because he can't do it. He can't cop to it. He can't do that role.
No, I think every place he goes, look at TV, they make the man look like an idiot. The only one who knows anything at home is the woman. And every place.
Yeah, the TV ads are horrible, but most TV ads, the ad industry is run by guys like Galliano, the designer. Okay, they're all about the same. The mentality is the same, and that's why they denigrate the male. I understand that. But by the way, they don't just target the white male. I've seen them do this, by the way, recently to the black male in ads, too. It's disgusting. Every male, whether it of any race, is denigrated in ads, turned into some kind of schlemiel, non-human, like a weakling. The lawnmower falls out of his hand. He sets the barbecue on fire. He falls over, and mommy has to come save him, right?
Yes. Yes. It's like the mother is the only one who knows what's going on. And I think, you know, as a young boy...
So in other words, if you want to put it in that bigger context, it is the women's movement who has tried to make the male irrelevant. They have made the male irrelevant. They want the matriarchy to run America on some principle idea that the matriarchy is somehow better than the patriarchy, and a matriarchy will save America. Well, how did that work out? Just take a look at the White House. Take a look at Hillary Clinton. How's that worked out with the matriarchy in power?
Michael, did you
How's that worked out with Michelle Obama in the White House running everything? And by the way, it's alleged on the inside that the advisors to the president are his wife and his mother-in-law. That they're really running the country. How's that worked out for the country?
Yeah, it looks good, huh? Did you ever look at that study that they did on elephants? I know it's ridiculous, it sounds stupid, but male elephants, they were so worried about all these poachers getting all the elephants, they decided to move a whole bunch of them out. But they didn't have the tools to get the big buck males out. They didn't have the machinery to get them out. So they got females and young. What started to happen over a year or so is that the males began to form gangs and beat up the other females, things that in the elephant community.
Wow, you're kidding. You mean once the elephant family structure broke down, they became wild?
It got so bad that the young female elephants were being raped rather than joining into family relationships with the other young males. But what they be some smart scientist, and I wish I remember his name.
Whoa, this is some story. Wow.
Good. Anyway, what he said, well, you know, maybe we need to bring back the bulls. By this time, all the young male elephants were just, they ran the river. Nobody can go and drink without their permission. They ran in gangs. They were just terrible. They were beating up the other animals around. Anyway, they finally got large enough machinery and tools to get the huge bull males there.
And
okay,
what happened?
So one day, these bull males are just, you know, nonchalant, maybe only four of them, nonchalantly going down to the watering hole. And they're going
to... You're starting
water.
To sound like Janet Napolitano now.
No, oh, no, no, listen.
No, I don't mean the elephant analogy. I mean your voice suddenly shifted into Big Sis. So go on. What's the end of the story?
Okay, the interesting thing is that nobody got in his way. These young guys just moved aside, and they took testosterone levels. Do you know that prior to those bull male elephants going there, that the
T levels on these young boys was through the roof. Once the older males began, you know, asserting themselves just by the very way they were walking, they didn't have to do anything.
Right.
The T levels, the testosterone levels in these young males started to go way down. They became
You're kidding.
Became
That's
more
an amazing story. I mean, this is a hell of a study. Heck of a study.
Well, see, you speak my
Sandy,
language.
Sandy, are you a scientist? What do you do?
Oh, I'm a registered nurse, but my mind is in other places.
Yeah, this is a heck of a story about elephants. You know that that's a weakness of mine, elephants.
There's so many things, you know, and I know about the pesticides turning, you know, well, causing the body to produce female hormones.
Yes, that's right. Some of the plastics in our food and water supply in the environment mimic estrogenic compounds. There's no question about it. That's not mythology. Also, the high level of soy that's been introduced into the American diet is completely unnatural for this population, incidentally, and it's also feminized men. Do you know that? Soy-based products also mimic estrogenic-like compounds.
I know. But you know what I found out? Is it's almost impossible.
Well, no, let's go into diet for a minute. It's something I'm an expert in. Do you know how many young boys have been raised for 20 years on low-fat, no-fat diets? No meat, low-fat, no-fat diets? Have you any idea what that does to a child?
Right. Without fat, you can't absorb. You can only do vitamin C and B complex. You know, they're water soluble.
The boys are nutritionally deficient. They're deprived of hormone building blocks, and so they're not developing into full male. So I really have not even talked about the nutritional component of this extended childhood, so to speak, or extended boyhood. I appreciate your call very much. Savage.